Chapter 13. Despite the people and activity around him, Pitt was captivated by the dense silence of the cold north. There was an incredible stillness about it that seemed to overwhelm the voices and sounds of machinery. He felt as though he were standing in numbing solitude inside a refrigerator on a desolate world. Daylight finally appeared, filtered by a peculiar gray mist that permitted no shadows. By mid-morning, the sun began to burn away the icy haze, and the sky turned a soft orange-white. The ethereal light made the rocky peaks overlooking the fjord look like tombstones in a snow-covered cemetery. The scene surrounding the crash site was beginning to resemble a military invasion. A fleet of 5 Air Force helicopters had been the first to arrive, ferrying an Army Special Service force of heavily armed and determined-looking men, who immediately cordoned off the fuselage and began patrolling the entire area. An hour later, Federal Aviation Accident investigators landed and set about marking the scattered wreckage for removal. They were followed by a team of pathologists who tagged and removed the bodies to the helicopters, which quickly airlifted them to the morgue at Thule Air Force Base. The Navy was represented by Commander Knight and the unexpected appearance of the Polar Explorer. All halted their grisly chores and turned their eyes toward the sea as a series of loud whoops from the ship's siren echoed off the jagged mountains. Dodging newly formed ice calves, floating low and opaque, and the winter's first bergs, which resembled the ruins of Gothic castles, the Polar Explorer came about slowly and entered the mouth of the fjord. For a time, the ash-blue sea hissed quietly past the scarred bow, and then it turned to white. The immense prow of the icebreaker effortlessly bulldozed a path through the ice pack, heaving to less than 50 meters from the wreckage. Knight stopped engines, climbed down a ladder to the ice, and graciously offered the facilities of the ship to the security and investigation teams as a command post, an offer that was thankfully accepted without a second's hesitation. Pitt was impressed with the security. The news blackout had not yet been penetrated. The story given out at Kennedy Airport revealed only that the UN flight was overdue. It was only a matter of another hour before a shrewd correspondent got wise and blew the whistle. "I think my eyeballs just froze to their lids," Giordino said gloomily. He was sitting in the pilot seat of the Numa helicopter, trying to drink a cup of coffee before it froze. "Must be colder than a Minnesota dairy cow's tit in January." Pitt gave his friend a dubious look. "How would you know? You haven't been outside your heated cockpit all night." "I get frostbite by looking at an ice cube and a glass of scotch." Giordino held up one hand, all 5 fingers spread. "Look at that. I'm so stiff with cold I can't make a fist." Pitt happened to glance out the side window and spotted Commander Knight trudging over the ice from the ship. He walked back to the main cabin and opened the cargo door when Knight reached the boarding ladder. Giordino moaned in self-pity as his precious heat escaped and a frigid breeze engulfed the interior of the copter. Knight waved a greeting and climbed on board, his breath exhaling clouds of vapor. He reached inside his parka and produced a leather-covered flask. "A little something from the sick bay. Cognac. Can't begin to guess the brand. Thought you might find a good use for it." "I think you just sent Giordino to heaven," Pitt said, laughing. "I'd rather be in hell," Giordino muttered. He tipped the flask and savored the brandy as it trickled into his stomach. Then he raised his hand again and made a fist. "I think I'm cured." "Might as well settle in," said Knight. "We've been ordered to remain on station for the next 24 hours. If you'll pardon the awful pun, they want to keep us on ice until the cleanup is over." "How are the survivors doing?" inquired Pitt. "Miss Camille is resting comfortably. Incidentally, she asked to see you. Something about having dinner together in New York."
"Dinner?" asked Pitt innocently.
"Funny thing," Knight continued. "Just before Doc Gale surgically repaired the flight attendant's torn knee ligaments, she mentioned a dinner date with you, too." Pitt had a pure-as-the-driven-snow expression on his face. "I guess they must be hungry." Giordino rolled his eyes and tilted the flask again. "I think I've heard this song before." "And the steward?" "Rough shape," Knight replied. "But Doc thinks he'll pull through. His name is Reuben. While he was slipping under the anesthetic, he babbled some wild story about the pilot murdering the first and second officers and then vanishing in flight." "Maybe not so wild," said Pitt. "The pilot's body has yet to be found."
Not my territory, Knight shrugged. I've got enough to worry about without getting bogged down in an unsolved air mystery. Where do we stand on the Russian sub? Asked Giordino. We keep the lid on our discovery until we can report face-to-face with the big brass at the Pentagon. Stupid to fumble away the ball game through a communications leak. A piece of luck for us, at any rate, the plane crashing. Gives us the logical excuse to set a course for home and our dock in Portsmouth as soon as the survivors can be airlifted to a stateside hospital. Let's hope the unexpected diversion will confuse Soviet intelligence analysts enough to get them off our back. Don't count on it, Giordino said, his face beginning to glow. If the Russians had the slightest suspicion we struck pay dirt, and they're paranoid enough to think our side caused the plane crash as a diversion, they'll come charging in with salvage ships, a protective fleet of warships, a swarm of covering aircraft, and, when they pinpoint the sub, raise and tow it back to their station at Severomorsk on the Kola Peninsula. Or blow it into smithereens, Pitt added. Destroy it? The Soviets don't have major salvage technology. Their prime objective would be to make certain no one else laid hands on it. Giordino passed the cognac to Pitt. No sense debating the Cold War here. Why don't we return to the ship where it's nice and warm? Might as well, said Knight. You two have already done more than your share. Pitt stretched and began zipping up his parka. Think I'll take a hike. You're not coming back with us? In a bit. Thought I'd look in on the archaeologists and see how they are. Wasted trip. Doc sent one of his medics over to their camp. He's already reported back. Except for a few bruises and strains, they were all fine. Might find it interesting to see what they've dug up, Pitt persisted. Giordino was an old hand at reading Pitt's mind. Maybe they've found a few old Greek amphoras lying around. Won't hurt to ask. Knight gave Pitt the benefit of a hard stare. Mind what you say. I have our geological survey story down pat. And the aircraft passengers and crew? They were all trapped inside the fuselage and died from hypothermia brought on by exposure to the frigid water. I think he's ready for the big sting, said Giordino dryly. Good, Knight nodded. You've got the right idea. Just don't suggest anything they have no reason to know. Pitt opened the cargo door and gave a casual nod. Don't wait up. Then he stepped into the cold. Persistent cuss, Knight muttered. I didn't know Pitt was interested in antiquities. Giordino gazed through the cockpit window as Pitt set off across the fjord. Then he sighed. Neither did he. The ice field was firm and flat, and Pitt made good time across the fjord. He scanned the ominous gray cloud ceiling rolling in from the northwest. The weather could change from bright sunshine to a blinding blizzard within minutes and obliterate all landmarks. He wasn't keen on wandering lost without even a compass, and he increased his pace. A pair of white gerfalcons soared above him. Seemingly immune to the Arctic cold, they were a select group of birds that remained in the north during the harsh winter. Moving in a southerly direction, he crossed the shoreline and kept his bearings on the smoke that rose above the archaeologist's hut. The distant and indistinct smudge appeared as though seen through the wrong end of a telescope. Pitt was only 10 minutes away from the camp when the storm struck. 1 minute he could see nearly 20 kilometers. The next, his visibility was cut to less than 5 meters. He started jogging, desperately hoping he was traveling in something remotely resembling a straight line. The horizontally driving snow came against his left shoulder, and he leaned into it slightly to compensate for his drift. The wind increased and beat against him until he could barely stand. He shuffled blindly forward, looking down at his feet, counting his strides, his arms huddled about his head. He knew it was impossible to walk sightless without gradually wandering in a circle. He was also aware that he could walk past the archaeologist's hut, missing it by a few meters, and stumble on until he dropped from exhaustion. Despite the high wind chill factor, his heavy clothing kept him reasonably warm, and he could tell by his heartbeat that he was not unduly exerting himself. Pitt paused when he calculated that he was in the approximate vicinity of the hut. He continued walking another 30 paces before stopping again. He turned to his right and moved over about 3 meters until he could still see his footprints trailing off in the blowing snow from the opposite direction. Then he walked parallel to his original path, mowing the lawn as if he was searching for an object beneath the sea. He took about 60 steps before his old footprints faded and disappeared in the snow. He walked 5 lanes before he swung to his right again, repeating the pattern until he was sure he had retraced the now obliterated center line. Then he picked up the grid again on the other side. On the 3rd lane, he stumbled into a snowdrift and fell against a metal wall. He followed it around 2 corners before meeting a rope that led to a door. With a great sigh of relief, Pitt pushed open the door, savoring the knowledge that his life had been in danger and he had won. He stepped inside and tensed. This was not the living quarters, but rather a large Quonset-like shelter covering a series of excavations in the exposed earth. The interior temperature was not much above freezing, but he was thankful to be safe from the gale-force wind. The only light came from a Coleman lantern. At first he thought the structure was deserted, but then a head and pair of shoulders seemed to rise up from a trough in the ground. The figure was kneeling, facing away from Pitt, and seemed absorbed in carefully scraping loose gravel from a small shelf in the trough. Pitt stepped from the shadows and looked down. "Are you ready?" he asked. Lily spun round, more puzzled than startled. The light was in her eyes, and all she could make out was a vague form.
"Ready for what?"
"To go out on the town." The voice came back to her. She lifted the lamp and slowly rose to her feet. She stared into his face, captivated once again by Pitt's eyes, while he was taken by her dark red hair that glinted like fire under the bright light of the hissing Coleman.
"Mr. Pitt, isn't it?"
She slipped off her right glove and extended her hand. He also removed his glove, reached out, and gave her hand a firm squeeze.
"I prefer attractive ladies to call me Dirk."
She felt like an embarrassed little girl, mad at herself for not having any makeup on, wondered if he noticed the calluses on her hand. And to make it worse, she could feel herself blushing.
"Lily, Sharp," she stammered. "My friends and I were hoping we could thank you for last night. I thought you were joking about dinner. I really didn't think I'd see you again."
"As you can hear," he paused and tilted his head toward the moaning wind outside, "a blizzard couldn't keep me away."
"You must be crazy."
"No, just stupid for thinking I could outrun an Arctic storm." They both laughed and the tension fell away. Lily began to climb out of the excavation trough. Pitt took her arm and helped her up. She winced and he quickly released his grip.
"You shouldn't be on your feet."
Lily smiled gamely.
"Stiff and a little sore from a sea of black and blue marks I can't show you, but I live."
Pitt held up the lantern and peered around the oddly grouped rocks and excavations.
"Just what is it you have here?"
"An ancient Eskimo village, inhabited 100 to 500 years after Christ."
"Have you a name for it?"
"We call the site Grundquist Bay Village after Dr. Hiram Grundquist, who discovered it 5 years ago.
"One of the 3 men I met last night?"
"The big man who was knocked unconscious."
"How's he getting along?"
"Despite a large purplish dome on his forehead, he swears he doesn't suffer from headaches or dizziness. When I left the hut, he was roasting a turkey."
"Turkey?" Pitt repeated, surprised. "You must have a first-rate supply system."
"A vertical-lift Minerva aircraft, on loan to the university by a wealthy alumnus, flies in once every 2 weeks from Thule."
"I thought excavations this far north were limited to midsummer when above-freezing temperatures thawed the ground."
"Generally speaking, that's true. But with the heated prefab shelter over the main section of the village, we can work from April through October."
"Find anything out of the ordinary, like an object that doesn't belong here?"
Lily gave Pitt a queer look.
"Why do you ask?"
"Curiosity."
"We've unearthed hundreds of interesting artifacts representing prehistoric Eskimo lifestyles and technology. We have them in the hut if you care to examine them."
"How's chances of looking at them over the turkey?"
"Good to excellent. Dr. Grundquist cooks gourmet."
"I had hoped to invite you all to the ship's galley for dinner, but the sudden storm messed up my plans."
"We're always happy to see a new face at the table."
"You've discovered something unusual, haven't you?" Pitt asked abruptly. Lily's eyes widened suspiciously.
"How could you know?"
"Greek or Roman?"
"Roman Empire. Byzantium, actually."
"Byzantium what?" Pitt pushed her. His eyes turned hard. "How old?"
"A gold coin, late 4th century.
He seemed to relax then. He took a deep breath and slowly let it out while she looked at him in confusion and no small degree of irritation.
"Make your point," Lily snapped at him.
"What if I was to tell you," Pitt began slowly, "there is a trail of amphoras scattered along the seabed that leads into the fjord."
"Amphoras?" Lily repeated in astonishment.
"I have them on videotape from our underwater cameras."
"They came."
She spoke as in a trance. They really crossed the Atlantic. The Romans set foot on Greenland before the Vikings.
The evidence points in that direction. Pitt eased his arm around Lily's waist and aimed her toward the door. Speaking of direction, are we stuck here for the duration of the storm, or does that rope outside the door lead to your hut? She nodded.
Yes, the line stretches between the two buildings.
She paused and stared into the excavation where she had discovered the coin.
Pythias, the Greek navigator, made an epic voyage in 350 BC. The legends say he sailed north into the Atlantic and eventually reached Iceland. Strange there are no records or legends telling of a Roman voyage this far north and west, 750 years later.
Pythias was lucky. He made it home to tell the tale.
You think the Romans who came here were lost on the return voyage?
No, I think they're still here. Pitt looked down at her with a determined grin. And you and I, lovely lady, are going to find them.